So tonight I'm going to bring up a koan from the Mumon Kan. But before I do that, I want to just kind of set the stage for the koan. So regarding this practice of Zazen and Zen practice in general, I think one way to view it, and it's a little bit structured, but I think it's valid, is there are three kind of main aspects. We tend to work on them one at a time, but they all happen together. The first aspect is the one that I so often emphasize, particularly because I think it's so important, both for students new to the practice who are getting into the deeper side of Zazen, not just struggling with thoughts, but now starting to enter kind of a dhyana state. Remember, the meaning of Zen is, it comes from the Sanskrit word dhyana, which means absorption. So this first movement or effort or effect of the practice is to put us into a very intimate direction. I call it penetrating Zazen. We go deep, deep, deep to the center of the universe in a sense. What we see there has no particularities, yet it is absolutely intimate, and it's alive, and it is what you might call the very space within which things can be. Sometimes I refer to it as absolute time. It's time that doesn't move because you're so in the present moment that the movement of time, which happens in form, kind of drops away, and now you're just left with the sense of presence. So this penetrating Zazen has been described in this system by a famous Zen master. His name was Tozan Ryokai. And Tozan Ryokai was quite famous for his development of what was called the five ranks. Now, the three stages of practice that I'm talking to you about could loosely be described as this first rank practice, this penetrating Zazen. We've talked about it many times. Turning the light of the mind in on itself and not stopping. The second rank is, in a sense, not, I wouldn't call it the opposite, but it's finding no particularities in the direction in which you used to identify with an entity. Suddenly the world bursts into view as not apart from you. So it's a kind of looking outward. You might call it a profound awareness that there is no dividing line. So you could say that it is the bursting into your awareness of self with a capital S and the simultaneous falling away or viewing as illusory, the sense of a small self and entity standing apart. This happens in the world of form. It's called second rank. And there is a second rank practice of Zazen, which I will go into tonight. That practice happens both on the cushion and in your everyday life, cutting carrots, driving a car, talking to your friend, whatever it might be. And then there's this third realm, which is a lifelong aspect of practice. You could loosely call it third rank. Third rank in the Tozan's five rank system denotes someone who has really entered into the second rank of not seeing the world as outside, seeing everything as intimate, but allowing the awareness that they're doing that to fade away. So that's very natural. And it's a persistent mindfulness, moment by moment by moment, as a practice, with the aim of letting go of the stuck places. Now, what are these stuck places? They're all the things we ever learn. They're all the habits, the habitual feelings and reactions, the what you might call neuroses. In Buddhism, they're called the kleshas, the kleshas. You might call it false thinking. But it's this reaction to the world that is oftentimes either painful, selfish, self-centered, that seems to come up unbidden and interferes with this realm that we are learning about. It seems to be an old self that won't go away. But in this third rank practice, which is a lifelong practice, more and more we don't oppose that. We just see it as not a self. We see it as habit patterns. The world has a lot of things that have momentum and gradually peter out. They don't stop suddenly all the time. So we become very spacious about it, and we do this continual practice. It is, in a sense, a merger of first and second rank, this third rank. The first rank is seeing clearly that there is no entity with form inside. And the second rank is seeing no division between oneself and the world that used to appear to be opposing an entity. And we bring those together with mindfulness, footstep after footstep. And there's a gradual process of refinement. You call it character building, refinement. Now, it's often said that one's personality never changes throughout one's life. I think that's probably pretty true. You can meet an old friend that you knew in grade school at a reunion, for example. And there's something about that person, it's just a trace that's definitely there. You recognize that right away. That's what you might call personality. It's kind of the way our genetics and our body and our mind is wired, and perhaps our deep life experiences. But character is on a different level. Character is very malleable. It doesn't usually change because people don't ordinarily do this kind of work, although it may often change as a result of various life experiences. But in our Zen practice, character building is letting go of the habitual separating from the world around us. And we gradually, it doesn't happen rapidly, gradually become more open-hearted, more compassionate, less afraid. And so that's the realm of the third rank, or this third movement. So the first movement is this penetrating zazen. The second movement is what you might call expansive zazen. And the third movement is this gradual process of character refinement. So I most often talk about this first rank penetrating zazen practice. But tonight I'm going to talk about second rank now. This expansive, it's a movement outward. Sometimes it's a bursting outward. But it's not always like that. And after you've suddenly tripped over this state, you need to bring it back, and then it's not so startling. It's just you have to remind yourself that what appeared to be a solid world confronting you, a world that, in a sense, in the word that I use is existed, which from the Latin means ex ist, to stand is ist, ex is outside, to stand outside. We view the world as standing outside, an entity inside. And this state is realizing that from the very beginning, as the sixth patriarch said, in his poem that he wrote on the wall that the fifth patriarch recognized and then handed him the robe and bowl in a famous story, and there's a koan on that, in the Mumenkan, and I believe it also appears in the Hekigan Roku. So he said from the very beginning, and this is in his poem, not a single thing has ever existed. What a puzzling line. I remember reading this early in my days of learning about Zazen and Zen Buddhism and wondering what it meant. What does he mean? Nothing ever existed. To me, the most obvious thing was the existence of a world, a concrete, solid world. Now, as we learn more and more about the universe with our Large Hadron Colliders and theoretical physics, quantum theory, string theory, it's just being shown over and over again through experimentation and thought experimentation that the world only comes in being when it is observed. Before the world is observed, it's what we call a probability cloud. It's not really there, it's just that it's a probability of being somewhere, more likely than somewhere else. But it's only with the act of observation that the world bursts into view and becomes what it is. declares itself, so to speak. So what quantum physics tells us is that the world that we view as existing cannot be without us, without the knower. Now, quantum physics posits some knower or knowing, and then a world that comes into being. And Zen does not do this. The knower and the world are not separate in Zen. They're one substance, a live substance. In Zen, this is called emptiness. It's one of the ways we describe this world of awakening. So if not a single thing has ever existed, stood outside, then what is this thing we are perceiving? Well, it's empty of self-nature. It's empty of standing outside as a concrete, self-existing thing. So this is one way of understanding this word emptiness. So I'm going to read a koan tonight that deals with this expansive second rank. Now, it is puzzling to hear these koan. They don't make immediate sense, and they're not intended to make sense in terms of fitting into a framework of our intellect that we have utilized throughout our life to categorize things and to understand the world in a mechanistic way. These koan, when we struggle with them, to really get it, and to get a koan means to be able to demonstrate it, to go before the teacher and show the answer, not just describe it or talk about it, but show it, requires a kind of a leap. And the leap is not something that you can necessarily, consciously, and deliberately take. It requires inquiry and a desire to break through, a deep questioning, and a willingness to not know, profoundly not know, not to seek the answer in the realm of knowing. This is a very, very important aspect of koan practice, but I feel also zazen is to become very comfortable with not standing apart as an entity knowing something outside. Sometimes I say in a koan, you look up at it, not down on it. So I'm going to read this koan, and hopefully we'll have a little time to discuss it. So this is koan number 6 from the Mumon Khan, and the title of it is The Buddha Holds Up a Flower. And this is actually a historical case. There is a place that's mentioned in this koan. So I'll read the case first, and I'll tell you a little bit about this place. So once, when the world honored one, the Shakyamuni Buddha, in ancient times was upon Mount Grudakuta, this is Vulture Peak. He held up a flower before the assembly of monks. Some descriptions as he twirled a flower. At this, all were silent. The venerable Kashyapa, or Mahakashyapa, the great Kashyapa, who was his head student, alone broke into a smile. The world-honored one said, quote, I have the all-pervading eye of the true Dharma, the secret heart of incomparable nirvana, the true aspect of formless form. It does not rely on letters, and it is transmitted outside the scriptures. I now hand it on to Mahakashyapa. So this story depicts what we Zen Buddhists claim to be the very first, and the word is transmission. Transmission means passing from teacher to student, or a mutual recognition between them of the mind of awakening. So that's this is a description of the very first Zen transmission. It happened during the time of Shakyamuni, when he twirled the flower and Mahakashyapa smiled. Let me say a little bit about Vulture Peak. There is a real place called Vulture Peak. There might be a tiny little sign pointing at it, but there's no boardwalk, there are no stores, there's It's no souvenirs. It's in the middle of a somewhat wooded area in India, northern India, I believe. And you can go there, and you can hike up it. Nobody asks you for any money. You don't have to buy tickets. There's no necessary lines of tourists. You can go up to Vulture Peak, where many of Buddha's sutras were first spoken as Taisho to his monks. Now, Richard Clark was there. He described this to me, so that's why I'm telling you this. He also said that on Vulture Peak, there has been for many, many years, I don't know how many years now, Japanese monks who strike this drum. There's two monks, one on either side of a giant drum that you can hear for miles. And you hear this thump, 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 like that every 1 or 2 seconds. And it goes on 24 hours a day, never stops, 365 days a year, year after year after year. It's kind of their way of, in an auditory fashion, keeping the flame of Dharma alive. Now you might say this is totally crazy and insane, but that's what's up there. So that's Vulture Peak. So when we look at this case, let's say we were actually working on this. What is this about? First of all, why did Buddha hold up a flower? What was the meaning of that? What is the flower, in a sense, and this is the intellectual mind, what does the flower symbolize, right? Well, flowers are beautiful, they have a lovely fragrance, something peaceful about them, something joyful about them, something transient about them. So maybe the Buddha was showing this combination of peaceful, joyful, inviting and transient. You remember that saying from Dogen, he said, though we hate them, weeds grow. Though we love them, flowers fall. Well, this was the flower that the Buddha held up. So does this flower symbolize something? And then why was it that everyone was silent when he did this? He held this up. And why was Mahakashyapa alone smiling? And how did the Buddha recognize through this smile something about Mahakashyapa that later was called the very first Zen transmission? And then why did he say these incredibly poetic words? I have, holding this flower up, I have the all-pervading eye of the true Dharma, the secret heart of incomparable nirvana, the true aspect of formless form. It does not rely on letters and is transmitted outside the scriptures. I now hand it on to Mahakashyapa. Why did he say that? So this flower seems to be central to the story. And what we need to do is set aside our ordinary thinking mind about this. First of all, that the flower symbolizes something. What if Buddha picked up a stick? Some masters have picked up sticks, fly swatters. Uman talked about a dried shit stick being the essence of the Buddha. Kanshiketsu, dried shit stick. So what is this? We have to enter this not knowing and yet keep this scene in our eye, the Buddha holding up this flower and twirling it, and Mahakashyapa smiling, and something was transmitted. What was transmitted? We have to go so deep into this questioning. What was transmitted? What was the mutual acknowledgement, you might say? What were they acknowledging? What were they both noticing that perhaps the other many monks up in Vulture Peak couldn't see? You might say most people can't see this. It isn't hidden, but our ideas and notions, for example, that the world exists, the world stands outside of an entity that's inside, and the entity inside has characteristics, peering out through through eyes and ears at a foreign world, a world that has its own self-existence, people that have their own self-existence, so everything is chopped up and separate. This is how we all have been taught. and how we all see the world. Until we really do this penetrating zazen, and then suddenly, as the six patriarchs said, things no longer exist, stand outside. So now this question is, the Buddha is holding this flower. Does this flower exist or not exist? Does it stand outside me, or is it something else? What is it? There has to be a profound questioning here. The Buddha's holding up this flower. Mahakashapa notices something immediately and smiles, and there was a mutual recognition in the transmission. The very first transmission of Zen Buddhism occurred at that very moment, and now we're reading about it more than 2,500 years later. And this is a teaching story, a koan that has survived through many centuries. So, let's talk about this. When you do zazen, there are sounds happening. There's a sensation, because the fans are on right now, of a coolness on your skin. There's the feeling of your body on the mat. There's your breathing. Whatever your focal point is for your zazen, all these things are happening. They're all happening. Now, if you were to deeply look inside to find out who is it that's experiencing it, and not finding that, not finding any particularity, nothing that has a particular form, color, sound, smell, taste, touch, because you're no longer fooled by the thoughts arising. They're kind of like the wind on your skin. They're kind of like the sounds in the room, the appearance of the light on the floor or the wall. So these things are happening, but they're not of a different substance than all these other things. It's just that we identify with them, but that's kind of arbitrary. We were taught to do that and it became a habit. And as we do our zazen, we begin to understand that that's not what's hearing this sound. That the feeling of a me inside with its characteristics, this sensation of a self, is known in some way, but it can't know. It's known, but it can't hear. The sensation can't hear. The sensation can't see. We start to pull the rug out from under it. We begin to notice that the sensation of me and the sound in the room and the light hitting our eye and the feeling of our knees on the mat are all one fabric of sensation. One fabric. So what is it that's hearing it? Now, Basui recommended a koan, "Who am I?" And he would say to his monks, and he said this in the Sermon on the One Mind, which I've read parts of before, he said, "Though you search for an entity that hears, you will not find it. Though you search for an entity that hears, you will not find it, but continue to search." Because something obviously is hearing. There's sound, right? So there's a flower here. Something obviously is seeing the flower. There's a flower. Well, what is that? And what is the flower? Is it possible that the flower is seeing? That seeing is embedded in flowers. That hearing is embedded in noises. That coolness is embedded in sensation. Embedded. Why does it have to be apart from? Remember quantum physics now. Quantum physics says without an observation, the world does not come into being. There's some mysterious connection between the observer and the world as it appears. Now, one theoretical physicist, David Bohm, he was a British physicist, very famous, he's dead now. He said, the stuff of the universe is mind stuff. The stuff of the universe is mind stuff. The substance of a flower is mind stuff. The substance of my knees on the mat is mind stuff, meaning an intimate appearance with no separate entityness. Now we're beginning to peer in a little deeper. So I'm going to read the commentary here. So the commentary by Mumon, and this is quite ironic. Golden-faced Kudon, K K-U-D-O-N is one of the appellations of the Buddha. He's using this in kind of a dismissive way. He says, golden-faced Kudan is certainly outrageous. He turns the noble truth into something lowly. He's selling dog flesh. I'm trying to read the handwriting here. Dog flesh identified as sheep's head. All right, so sheep's head apparently was a delicacy. And the dog is the lowest form of life in China. It's as low as a rat is in our culture. The dogs are very low. So the implication here is the Buddha is holding up some teaching that is really dog flesh being advertised as sheep head. He's fooling the country bumpkins. Okay, this is ironic. So he says, advertising sheep's head, he sells dog flesh, but with some genius. He softens it a little bit, with some genius. However, supposing that at the time all the monks had smiled, how would the all-including eye of the true Dharma have been handed on? Or again, if Kashyapa had not smiled, how would the true Dharma have been transmitted? If you say that the true Dharma can anyway be handed on, the golden-faced old man, this is another way of describing the Buddha, the golden-faced old man, with his loud voice, deceived the simple villagers. If you say it can't be transmitted, why did the Buddha say he handed it on to Kashyapa? So he's throwing at us even more sand to put us into a real pickle. What is this dog's flesh being sold as sheep's head? Remember, the Buddha's holding up a flower. And he makes these comments, these very poetic, lofty descriptions, holding this flower. I have the all-pervading eye of the true Dharma. So the eye of the true Dharma, where is this eye located? Remember this thing about seeing being embedded in that which is seen, embedded in, dissolved in. It's just this one thing. So this word just comes up here. I have the all-pervading eye of the true Dharma, the secret heart of incomparable nirvana, the secret heart. It's wonderful, this description. Incomparable nirvana, which is this absolute cessation of any activity of mind, one might say. But he said the secret heart. There's something intimate about this. I have something intimate. I have something that shines its own light. Kind of like the burning bush, the secret, this all-pervading eye, the secret heart, the true aspect of formless form. Although there's the appearance, the aspect of a flower, there's no substance outside you standing apart as a fixed entity that's there when you look away. That's how alive this is. This is why Richard Clark, the founding teacher of the Living Dharma Center, called it the Living Dharma Center. The Dharma is not a dead thing. It can't be described in words and scriptures. He says it does not rely on letters and scriptures. It's transmitted outside the scriptures. So what is transmitting it? Sound of the fan there? Feeling of coolness on your skin? Is not the world as it is continually transmitting the truth? Why do we need to resort to words and scriptures? This is what the Buddha is saying. So, the verse goes like this. Holding up a flower, the snake shows his tail. Kashyapa smiles. The monks don't know what to do. It's a beautiful, very brief and concise description of what's happening. Holding up a flower, the snake shows his tail. Think about that. The snake was sitting here and takes this long, whippy thing and holds it up to show it to you. What's he showing you? I said, oh, what's that whippy thing? Oh my God, that's the snake itself, right? The tail is not separate from the snake. Holding up a flower, the snake shows his tail. Kashyapa smiles. the monks don't know what to do. Kashyapa's smile is shining it. The monks not knowing what to do is shining it. There's no judgment here. This is just cutting the carrots, just driving a car, just sitting in zazen, not elaborating ideas of an entity, going through the world, doing actions with some future goal. The actions are kind of throwaway because it's the end that counts, not the means. This is our ordinary way of living. But this koan very starkly thrusts this truth in front of us. The flower. Okay. So we'll end there tonight.